Okay, I'm going to start now. Do I have audio? Yeah, you can hear me out there? Am I being annoying? All right, my name is John Buckman. I submitted a talk to talk about squeezing the evil out of the music industry, because this conference was billed to me as a merging of free software and open culture. However, I think there's many more free software people here, and that's actually my background, moving into open culture. So I'm going to be changing the talk a little bit while still covering this topic. So the first thing I want to mention, and I'm going to give other speakers a really damned hard time, I don't want to come to this conference and not see presentations that are not GPL or Creative Commons. Every presentation here should be open sourced. Okay? That's really, really important. And only maybe five of them have been. So make sure they're open sourced, and there should be a URL on the page, the first page, of where you can download it. There aren't people here doing this, but at many conferences, people suck down my laptop and my presentation, they look at it on their computer, take notes as I go. That's as it should be. Many people will be blogging if these things were available in open source. So I just want to mention that. Also, this is my email address. This is under a BY-SA Creative Commons license, so you're free to do anything you want with it, as long as you keep it free. The biggest change in this talk is going to be that I'm going to make it quite a bit more personal. Rather than talking about just my corporate side, I want to talk about how I went from being an open source geek to being, this is code I wrote, to being an open culture nerd. From being utterly legally ignorant to hopefully having something of a clue. I want to show this to you. So this is something I did in 1993. It was called the Desktop Internet Reference. At the time, it was fairly popular. It was when Yahoo was still at Stanford. And this was what the license said, right? It's in the public domain and may not be sold. Now, those of you who've read license will realize that this is completely nonsensical. If it's in the public domain, you can do anything you want with it. I can't prevent you. But what was interesting is I at least had a notion of this idea of I want freedom, but I would like to keep it out of the commercial domain. And that license, I actually had a clause that said that you could charge distribution fees of less than $10 for it. So I was trying to do something, but I had no idea what I was doing from a legal standpoint. Then I discovered Richard Stallman, who made life very simpler. There was one true path. It was the GPL. It was freedom. Thou shalt not deviate from freedom. And I loved him for that. And so I started doing a lot of open source stuff, not just at SourceForge, but publishing. This is an article I wrote for SysAdmin. I got a huge flame war over this because I wrote high-performance applications on Solaris, Windows, Linux, and FreeBSD, and benchmarked them to see which OS is actually better at running internet apps. And people didn't want to hear, which is an interesting thing. You'd think, actually, this sort of thing would happen more often, but very rarely do people compare OSs in this way. When I started moving to culture and looked at the GPL, there were some real problems with it, but I was really inspired by the OSI, the Open Source Institute, that defines open source in terms of 10 principles. And if you haven't looked at this, I really recommend you go look at it. Because as a coder, you go look at this, you look at the 10 points, everything in those 10 points will resonate in the GPL. But step away from the code for a second and think, how would these 10 points apply to my blog, to a song, to a movie? And they all do. All the things that you think about and you treasure in the open source world apply to cultural products as well. And because you feel it in your heart, you're excellent vehicles for communicating that outside of this room into spaces where they don't know about this, they don't know the benefits, they don't know how it can transform culture. This is a page from Magnatune, it's an artist page, and you'll notice right here is a Creative Commons logo. So that's sort of my movement from code to music. And then, having gone from GPL to Creative Commons, I was on the Creative Commons board for a while. And rah-rah, CC, GPL, bad, dogmatic, CC, choice, yay. Kind of got over that. Now I'm blissfully enlightened. It's all good. With Magnatune, these are all actually commercial projects that I financially support. So Emmerok and Rhythmbox and Songbird all get money from Magnatune. in various ways, both direct for programming assistance and also in sales they help cause. Slim is a closed hardware device, but it has an open API and open source backend that also supports Magnatune. So this is one part of the ecology that I do with Magnatune. Another is Bang & Olufsen and Renault. I want to explain those two cases. It's interesting how open source ideas can be applied to business. So Bang & Olufsen has a major license that they have announced with Magnatune. What they wanted to do was ship products with music. Very simple. They didn't want DRM because they wanted music to flow between their products. They wanted you to like something and move it. They wanted you to go to a hotel room, and if there's a B&O device there, you should be able to listen to music in the hotel room. The major labels don't like that. They want DRM, they want restriction, they want scarcity. Bang & Olufsen wanted all the benefits they see from the open world. Unfortunately, no one had music that was any good that was open except Magnatune, so they were kind of stuck licensing it with us, which is, you know, good for me, until some other people figure out that it's a decent business model to have good music that's open. Hopefully that won't happen anytime soon for my sake, but not for the culture's sake. Renault, another interesting case. There's a car called Mégane. It's an extremely boring, cheap, small car. They came out with a new model in 2006. They handed it to their PR agency and said, make this sexy. And the PR agency said, it can't be done. And then they thought about it some more, and they said, we know, we're going to make the new Renault Mégane your music discovery vehicle. When you get into a Mégane, it's going to have 30 gigs of music already there that you've never heard of. When you sit in the car, you just hit what you want to play, and it happens. And even better, we're going to make it DRM-free. We're going to put a USB slot in it and give you a little thumb drive. So while you're listening to music, if there's something you like, you just put the thumb drive in, it copies the MP3, you take it with you. Wouldn't that be amazing? In fact, that's what they end up doing with Magnatune. But the wise people at Renault said, this is a feature. We should sell this. We'll make it an $800 option on the Renault Mégane. You can imagine how many people then bought it, which is to say very, very few, which is too bad because they had a real opportunity to make something very different. They did all the license, all the technology, but at the last minute decided to take a different approach to it. Everyone knows the Blair Witch Project film. What they might not know is the people who do or did the Blair Witch Project have made several other films. They have a very healthily negative attitude about the music industry. They don't like working with them. One of the reasons is they were rejected with the Blair Witch Project for distribution. It was extremely hard for them to get out. But also, they have many completely reasonable ideas for what they want to do with their films. For example, they did a film called The Strand, which was 12 one-hour episodes. And what they wanted to do was release it on the web 1 hour at a time, 1 week at a time, for free, in a little window. At any point, you could send them $100, and they would send you all 12 episodes, so you didn't have to wait 12 weeks. Seems like a reasonable business model. Now, you're a major label, and you're looking at this going, no, every time someone watches that free film, that's our music being played, and we would like some money. And a lot of money, in fact. At the last conference we were just at in Stockholm, the people from StarRec were there, talking about the music they had in their StarRec film. So their film was distributed, I believe it was 8 million times, it was downloaded. And the number they got from the collecting society, if they used normal money, so just collecting society money, would have been 1.5 million euros just to allow people to freely watch the movie. So you can imagine it's just not even possible to do this in a normal way. So the Blair Witch Project people regularly use Magnatune music because they want freedom and openness, because they want to explore, they want to do things that people actually want to buy. It's a strange thing rather than just suing people and making them suffer with what you're willing to sell them. Ubuntu and Canonical, can't talk too much about this other than say we have a partnership. The new version of Ubuntu that is coming out, actually the current beta, has deeper integration with Magnatune and the music. The Canonical has a really interesting portable edition of Linux they're putting out. Essentially, it's their iPhone competitor. Instead of going the Google Android way, what they're actually doing is a version of Ubuntu that works on phones, small platforms, and it's a combination of open source projects that are generic and stuff that they've written. The idea is you'll be able to take the equivalent of an iPhone, and when you buy it, you will have Last.fm, Magnitude, and Jamendo all streaming over 3G without any problems. That's really interesting. It's a really, I think, smart way to compete with the iPhone rather than Android, which is a kind of, well, half-baked approach to open source, frankly. The bottom line, though, is it's all good. These are all different approaches. Industries who are competing realize that openness is both competitive and it makes you money. Okay, that's my business point. Another part of my personal journey is I'm up on stage here and I seem quite extroverted. Well, if you met me 20 years ago, you'd actually have trouble recognizing me because I had a stutter, I couldn't make eye contact, and I certainly couldn't get on stage. And it changed for me. This is my little epiphany. I graduated from college. I was walking around waiting for my girlfriend to finish the day. And I saw this film called Defending Your Life. And here's a poster. And the basic idea, it's a tragical, serious comedy. Person dies, you go up to Judgment City, and you have to defend your life to a judge. And what you have to do is defend your life and say, were you fearful when things that were good that could have happened to your life, did you jump in and do it, or did you retract in fear? And there was a key part in this movie that was really touched me, was when this character had an opportunity to speak to his whole company, and then panicked and couldn't speak. And then he was never given that opportunity again. And at age 21, I was that person. And I knew that I had technical skills, but if I couldn't communicate, I would eventually doom myself. So what I did is I enrolled in this thing called Toastmasters, which is a totally open source public speaking group, essentially. What they do is it's all volunteers. You pay, I think it's $40 a year, and no one is a paid employee. And you come and you all have roles where you talk and you help each other learn how to speak and lead. It's global. It's very much here in Gothenburg and Stockholm, all over the world. If you're interested, go to Toastmasters. I can't recommend it highly enough. It will transform your life. And you can become extroverted by choice rather than introverted by nature. Obviously, these various things I've gone through have made me a bit more of an activist. I've been on the board of Creative Commons. I'm currently on the board of Electronic Frontier Foundation. The only problem with the EFF is they're so damn well organized and so effective that they actually have absolutely no need for me. but they serve really good food at the quarterly meetings, so I'm happy to show up. The Open Rights Group, thankfully, much younger, only I think 2 years old, well run, but still needs some help. This is a really wonderful UK-based group that helped change what's called the Gowers Report, which is an independent review of copyright, which went totally not the way the copyright holders wanted to go. It found no economic argument for copyright beyond 9 years. Okay, never mind 45-year extension. So the former editor of the Financial Times and his conservative crew found no argument from economics for copyright beyond 9 years. You can imagine the government was not happy about this. They tried to actually kill the thing. The Open Rights Group was instrumental in essentially leaking it to the press to make sure that it was treated fairly. It's had a major impact on the Brussels discussions about copyright extension and fair use, special library exemptions. Really important. So, really recommend. So another aspect of my own journey is the first real company I founded was something called Lyris. It's an email listserv, and it was created for very ideological reasons of helping people have more email discussions. Now this is 1994, right? So this is like 8 years before spam even happened. I'm talking about librarians, jokes of the day, you know, biochemists, all good stuff. And that's how I created the company. The problem is, it's called Lyris. It was a compared to Major Domo and Mailman, you probably know. But the problem is that eventually it made my life completely miserable and unhappy. And the reason was is I had to sell out. Simply, if I made a tool that did something that was useful, someone wanted to buy it, you sold it to them. And I was helping people communicate. Some of that communication was stuff that I didn't really like. I won't go into details, but this is an aspect of running a company that you have to think about, which is you can't choose who your customers are. You make a product, people buy it, they use it the way they want to. It's really a difficult aspect of being a programmer. is you make a product, but you don't control its destiny. So that when I finally sold Lyris, or got rid of it, depending on your perspective, I went and created Magnitune and put myself in a legal straitjacket by writing the legal agreement with my musicians such that I was prohibited from doing anything evil. So the slogan, in fact, is we are not evil. The contract with the musician is a 50-50 revenue split. There's just no arguing about revenue. It's not deductions or anything like that. There's no DRM. It's not exclusive. It couldn't go bad. And this was really important for me because it's 5.5 years into this now. I've actually lost money the first several years trying to build it out. Now it makes money, which is great. But this is what keeps me going. And, you know, I'm just about to hit 40, and I code 80 hours a week, and I love it because I feel good about it. Right now in your 20s, it's very easy to code like that. In 20, 30 years, it becomes harder unless you really love something. There was a really big mistake I made with Magnitune, though. What I tried to do, and I will explain Magnitune more in a bit, is I tried to modernize the record label concept. However, what I didn't change is I was still in the middle. I was still choosing the music that other people listened to, and that's limited the growth. Magnitune is a nice-sized company. It's got 6 employees. It makes a profit. But, you know, it's not mp3.com or any of the other Last.fm, Pandora, all these huge things that got out of the way and let lots of other people get involved. 2 years ago, I started something called Bookmooch, which has appeared to be a book exchange, and I'll just talk about that in a few minutes. I'm going to take a pause right now. So that was the personal side of the presentation. This is the homepage of Magnitune. On a certain level, it looks like a normal music site. You've got genres and albums, new releases, that sort of thing. Some things you might notice are a little weird. Independent music, okay, that's a little weird. Listen, download, or license, that's a little odd. What does that mean? I'll talk about membership in a bit. And then there's this propaganda thing about how we never work with major labels. Our musicians get half. You get to choose how much you want to pay. You get to listen to everything before you choose to buy, if you buy at all. These are different aspects. But the reality with Magnitune was piracy exists. Doesn't matter what the RIA is going to do. It exists. And the only way you can have a music business is to offer something better than Pirate Bay. The alternative, the approach is not to shut Pirate Bay down, but actually to outcompete them. So something that is better than piracy is the only future path for the music business, or at least the consumer music business. This is what an artist page looks like. Fairly consistently, you've got an artist looking at you, making contact. Everyone I've got on the site is a working artist and not some, you know, rich pool, Las Vegas, swinging type of person. And it's always straight about the music and easy to play. This is what the play page looks like. And you can't see below, but you can also download everything. It's available in AUG format. There's M3U exports, XSPF exports, so it works on all the Linux platforms. For example, a lot of people don't want to use a Flash player. You just click below and use your own player. If you want to hit license, for example, to get a free download, you can hit license and click non-commercial use. This is a click-through license of Creative Commons terms. You agree to that, you get a free download. Okay. The free download is 128K versions of all the MP3s, identical to the album with one difference. At the end of each song, a voice says, "You just heard Daybreak by Jamie Sieber from the album Hidden Sky from Magnitune." You are legally, completely free to remove that. However, most people don't bother. Right? That's the business model. Isn't it worth $5 to have me remove it and give you better audio quality? And you feel good? And actually, yeah, it is. No one ever bothers chopping it off. It's a good way to listen to the music and see if you like it. The transition, though, from non-commercial to commercial use is crucial. It's a way to underwrite this freedom that we really like. So while I went right to the non-commercial license, you can also go to a commercial license page. And the idea here is that many projects that start out free as non-commercial projects, like StarRec, for example, sometimes want to go commercial. And how do they do that? And how do I enable them to do that without impinging on their freedom? If you're a filmmaker and you want music, you as a filmmaker need to submit a script to the musician, and they approve the use of their music on your script. To me, that blows my mind. It's such an impingement on the filmmaker's creativity. And you can say, no, I don't like it. I don't like horror films. I don't like whatever. It's not a good way to respect or even run the arts. I don't do that. Another aspect is, how much money do you have? Right? A lot of musicians think, if it's a filmmaker, that they've got deep pockets, whereas filmmakers are actually usually dirt poor. So don't do that either. What I instead do is I say, basic questions will be on the web, and your budget, and where is it showing? Right? If your budget is quite small, like $100 or no budget, you're going to get this extremely cheap license. In this case, I'm choosing a $1,000 budget in festivals, and the price is $150, and bam, you're off. No one else on the internet offers transparent licensing. I don't know why. They just don't think. That's all I can tell you. This sort of thing has caused 2,500 licenses to occur in 5 years for unknown music. That's kind of unbelievable. Now, most of that stuff is small, but I feel good about it because it's starting and it's creating a new space. And it's about enabling freedom and yet having a business to underwrite freedom. None of this would have been possible if it weren't for the RIAA. So God bless the RIAA, because what they did is they put me on the map, right? So this is USA Today putting my mug on Kevin Meaney, who's the main technology columnist for USA Today, and how I'm going to compete with Steve Jobs. I just love that. In fact, Steve Jobs has got it wrong. John's got it right. Right, and I had 2 employees at the time. And the reason was that the RIAA was suing grandmothers and 14-year-olds and people on welfare, people who didn't even own computers. And half the journalists are freelancers who hate the RIAA. They hate this shit. And they started looking for business models that they actually could appreciate, that they wanted to support, and pitching it to their editors. So not only have you got Kevin Meaney, you've got Time Magazine, the top 20 music sites. Oh, look, Magnatune. Why am I there? I don't know, but I'm really happy. Wall Street Journal, Der Spiegel, Nisei Times, and then The Economist doing a full page on Magnitude, which doesn't make any sense. You can't even bribe them to do a full page. But there it is. Can open source approach be applied to the music business? I don't know, can it? But there was a huge problem. For 2 years, I didn't notice. The huge problem was my business model completely sucked. The business model was people come to the website, they listen to music, and because it's DRM-free and happy, happy, moral, they're going to send me money. And, well, no, actually they won't. Actually, they'll just come to the site and listen and send me love mail and write about me, but they won't send me any money. So that's the first problem on the consumer side. The second problem is Hollywood's going to come to me because all those tattooed editors who are into my death metal are going to recommend me. Well, no, actually the boss is going to go recommend the music from that girl that he slept with last week in that bar in L.A. Well, unfortunately, I haven't yet hired a fleet of hookers in L.A. That's the flaw of my business plan. Should have raised money for that. Didn't think about it. So, largely all the licensing is small, and I feel good about it, but it is small. Even the Bang & Olufsen thing, which is fabulous, it's a great reputation, it's not going to make anyone rich. But I'm really happy having them as a partner, but let's face it, that's the reality. And the download advantages we had, no DRM, high audio quality, musicians get paid, well, iTunes does that all now, right? iTunes can sign musicians directly, they have audio quality, it's good, and they have DRM-free stuff sometimes. So, yeah. Cory Doctorow has this nice saying, DRM is not a feature. He's right, but the converse is right too, which is the lack of DRM is not a feature. It just doesn't get in the way. But it's not like, oh good, you haven't put a lock on the door. Well, I still have to go open it. I still have to do things with it. This was a pretty painful thing for me to realize because I thought lack of DRM would be enough. The reality was people didn't want to be digital librarians and have to deal with all this stuff. And our consumer model was completely out of date. Specifically, in 1970, it was really cool to talk to your friends, listening to the radio, spend all of Saturday in the record shop finding the one album you wanted to buy, and then coming back and playing it and getting stoned with your friends. And then in the year 2000, Amazon said, we can do that, we'll just make it even bigger, even more records. Yeah, well, you know what, that's even more boring. It's even harder. If you want to go buy an album for a friend, go spend 4 hours on Amazon. That's really exciting. So the fact is, in 2008, no one wants to do this, which is why recommendation engines, but also things like Pandora and Last.fm are so hot, because that old shopping model is outdated. No one wants to do that. It's not that people don't want to buy music. They don't want to shop it. If you want proof, just go find a teenage girl, look at her iPod, and this is what you'll find. You'll find collections. Her friend Amy gave a bunch of music when she feels like she's with Amy. There's that cute DJ who made a mixtape for her. You know, that's kind of neat. She wants to relax. Or just some stupid pop thing. She just wants to feel good and dance while she's making tea. This is what you'll find. You'll find nothing about a band. That's just not how people think about music anymore. They think about it in moods and collections, emotional relationships. But not, I'm a big fan of these six bands. Also, being a music librarian, it's no fun, right? You download it, you gotta figure out where to store it, you gotta back it up, you gotta move it to your car. This is why the iPod is huge, because DRM makes it virtually impossible to have music where you want. So what everyone does is they take their DRM little dongle and they strap it to their belt and they take it with them. All right, that's an approach. But wouldn't it be nice to just have music in the cloud? And sometimes it's in the car, at home, at the office, strapped to you, whatever. You just don't have to think about it. The lack of DRM makes that possible, but it doesn't make it happen. And the bottom line is, people just want access to music. They don't want to think about it. They also want it curated. They want someone to curate it, whether it's an algorithm or a person, but they want things to not be such a pain in the neck. So for 2 years, we went, yay, huge press. Didn't really matter that our business model was lame. And then declining press, people not buying, business plummeting. Didn't know what to do. About 9 months ago, I had an aha moment. I was actually looking at the 16-year-old's iPod. Actually, she said, duh, no wonder your business is failing. It's completely lame. I would never buy music from you. Okay. I've got all the music I want, and I just want stuff that's available. So this is the new business model. Just help us stop selling you stuff. I don't want to sell you stuff. Just make it possible for me to just give you everything I've got and to just make you happy. So, not even that. I don't even know what the right price is. So, is it $5, $10, $20, $50 a month? I have no idea. In fact, it varies for everybody. So, this is what I do now, is I just ask people, how much do you want to give me per month? And then I say, great, I'll charge you every month. And then all our music is yours, in every way that we can think of. Right? And that means streaming from work, downloads, there's a 3G iPhone app coming out in a week, there's a web player, I mentioned Amarok, Rhythmbox, every application, every program, every device I can think of, I just throw someone from experts.com on it and write an app to make it work with our API. I don't have to think about it. And what this does is it changes the dynamic between me and the customer. They're not a customer anymore, they're an underwriter, a friend, they're a connector, they're a supporter, but they're no longer somebody that I shove product at. They're just somebody that I want to make happy. Okay. A few words, I'm going to go a little quickly on this, because it's kind of the less interesting stuff for this conference, but it turns out in the music industry, in the US, that's the number I have for, 18 billion, 12 billion of that is licensing. So two-thirds is actually the non-consumer stuff. And it's even more mind-blowing. Despite, you know, sales of albums going down, since 1980, revenues from collecting societies has tripled. Okay, so when the music industry is saying our business is dying, they're saying the sale of CDs through HMV and Virgin is dying. They're not mentioning that they're making three times more through GAMA, ASCAP, PRS, whoever. Two-thirds. That means that even if all the music was pirated and there was no consumer market, they would still have two-thirds of their business completely intact. But they're scared and stupid, and they own the government, so that's that. The cute thing is they're downsizing, so even if you have money that you want to give them, they won't return your phone call, which is kind of neat. However, I thought this would be a great opportunity, and fortunately, I was not the only one to notice this, and there are like 50 other companies now, including Getty Images, that are licensing music. They're not doing it through the open process that I am, but they are licensing music online, and they're outcompeting the majors. And more importantly, they have big names, which I don't have because I insist on the open side. So the niche that we've done is rights you can't get elsewhere. They see the Creative Commons license, they see all that attitude, and they think they can talk to us. Usually they're right. I talked about the Megane, the Strand, Bang & Olufsen, moving the things from this device to that device without any problem. All right, just summarize this part. Licensing is an okay business, but this is where we're focusing, on the open, the interesting stuff. I really think that the concept of selling individual tracks and albums has like a 5-year window. Just anyone under 20, the only reason they'll do it is because their parents are yelling at them to not pirate. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. For now, this works. I don't know how long it will, but for now it works, so I'll do it. Despite being the poster boy for a year or two, I had this dream that as Linux is to Microsoft and Linux is to Bill Gates, John would be to the evil music industry. And, for a short while, it looked like it might happen, and now I'm so last year. That's how it is. That's fine. I can live with it. Because I can still make a contribution, and frankly, being Mr. Big Shit has its problems. And frankly, it's a nice way to spend a decade, and I'm 5.5 years into it. Okay, so I'm going to have about 5 more minutes, and then I'm done with the presentations. And then you can all ask me, tell me, stuff. I mentioned 2 years ago that Magnitude was just plummeting. And at the time, I had no idea how to fix it. Didn't see a way out. Number of problems, my business model was lousy, but also I was in the middle, so the selection of music wasn't what they wanted. So I said, I'm going to make a brand new business. It actually can be a non-business. I'm just not going to make money. I'm just sick of making money. Don't want to do that. It's much more fun not to make money. I should mention, because I sold my previous company, I don't have to make money, which is a rare thing. But so there are benefits to selling out your principles. Just try to buy your soul back afterwards with the money you made. This is Book Mooch. Very simple idea. You can take this book. I don't know who it is. You read it. Once you're done, you say, I'll send it to anyone who wants it. So who wants it? You want it. I postal mail it to you. I get a point. I can now say, that book on your lap that you're done with, can you send that to me? Right. So it's been called BitTorrent for books. And that's a way to think about it. The thing that's interesting about it is that it's a world where there is no DRM. There's nothing legally preventing anything that's not illegal. What I'm thinking about is what could be the largest library in the world. And before I called it Book Mooch, and I'll explain that name in a second, I was calling it Book Commune internally. Now you can imagine in Europe, everyone understood what that was, and that was good. I buy a book, I put it in the commune, we all share it. Isn't that fun? In America, they thought I was a terrorist, and that wasn't so good. So I came up with this word, mooch. And a mooch is somebody, your neighbor who comes over and says, hey, can I just borrow $1 to buy a pack of cigarettes? And they have no intention of paying you back ever. Right? That's someone who mooches from you, someone who just asks for stuff and never gives back. It's supposed to be ironic. You're giving books away, getting books you want. The fact is, the point system makes sure that books, that no one actually mooches unfairly from anyone else. But it's a cute little thing. I like the word Yahoo and Google, so why not mooch? I'm the king mooch. So, home bookshelves around the world. Wouldn't that be amazing if we could put those into a large database, get everyone habituated to type into a computer, and send books on demand? That would be so much bigger than Amazon. Right, Amazon has, I think, something like 3 million books available. Imagine all the books ever printed available on every country without any currency being exchanged for the movement of books, as long as you play fair and you send your books. Right? There are books available for free. And my favorite part, nothing publishers can do. Because there's something called the first sale doctrine, and when you buy a book, you can sell it, and there's no DRM on a book. They can't break in your house and stop you from giving a book to somebody or posting it to somebody else. There's no such thing as book piracy, you know, if you lose the copy. Tough, they gotta live with it. Paper books are the CDs of the book industry. It's too good a format and too useful, and that's what it is. It does make a little bit of money. I don't want to lose money in case Book Mooch scales huge. I don't want to just die and not have the money to do it. The only way it makes money is some people choose to buy books on Amazon instead of freely trading them, and Amazon gives me 8% back. Today, that's $40,000 a month in money to Amazon. So even though Amazon really doesn't like me, sends me little nasty gram emails, says, we don't like free exchange, you can't use our API, and then I come back and say, well, I'll just go use Google's API then, and I won't send this $40,000 worth of leads to you each month. And then they go, oh, we'll get back to you. And this has happened like 4 times. And what's cute is, like, the great thing about Amazon is, like, every 3 months, like, everyone's been fired and new people there. So, we'll see. There are 20 companies in this space, and this kind of blew my mind. I did these numbers at the Frankfurt Book Fair 2 weeks ago. Book Crossing, Paperback Swap, Book Mooch. Never mind Book Mooch, Book Crossing. This thing is so freaking cool. If you don't know where it is, you read a book, you leave it in a public space, somewhere a little bit hidden, you list on the website that it's there, and someone gets it. So it's like total book anti-capitalist anarchy. And it works on a massive psychotic scale. It's a gift economy actually working. I just love it, and I just tried to basically rip everything I could off with a slight modification. Paperback Swap is a very much a business, and they're doing well, but they're just not anywhere near as cool as Book Crossing. This number blew my mind. I added all the memberships up of these various sites, and 2 million people have tried book swapping. And this is the number I came up with. 50,000 books every day swapped, so 3,000 a day on Book Mooch. These are really big numbers. I mean, this actually makes the public industry pause for a second, because you'll see in a second this scary chart. Book Crossing, Book Mooch, Paperback Swap, right? 8 million Google Juice, 1.2 million Google Juice. Haha, 840 Google Juice. Still a very good number. This is a really good chart. So Book Mooch has been around for 2 years. Look what happens when I annotate it. So first year, 300,000 books traded. Second year, 800,000 books traded. This year, somewhere between 2 and 5 million books will be traded. I project that out a couple of years, and you've got a real big problem for the other people. I'm crying crocodile tears. It's interesting, and it's going to be, I think, the first global repository of all human knowledge. Look at Google Books. It's got all this copyright mess. It's really not a free repository. There's no DRM on books. You can pass books around. It just won't be instant. You won't be able to pull up in your web browser. You've got to wait 2 weeks at most to get any piece of human knowledge from the book swapping networks. That's still pretty cool. So I'm going rah, rah, rah about this because it's kind of interesting. And let's not forget books in this whole thing. As soon as you digitize them, you're in DRM and copyright hell. But not with paper. So there you go. The last thing I'll mention is that a lot of the books in Book Mooch go to charities. So people who earn too many points give them to the charities. They get the books they want. If you work with a charity, please come talk to me or send me an email, because we actually still don't have enough charities. We've got 80 charities. People love giving books away to charity. That's it. Thanks, everyone. Let me know what you think. Ask questions. So. Anybody? Tick-tock. I'm just going to drink. Do you know this? I love that the previous speaker mentioned Arbuck, Mr. Fuller, because he used to do this public speaking trick. Before he'd come up, and then he'd actually talk. And so everyone was like totally uncomfortable. Like, why is the guy not talking? I haven't done that, well, except just now, but not before. It's a little mean. Actually, it's a lot mean. So, all right, if you don't have any questions, that's cool. I'll give it 5 more seconds. All right, thanks everyone for staying so late today, and I'll see you the next year. Thanks.